happening, present in the present, shaping the future, and residing within or even characterizing us, if we will only allow that. We have our rights. Why? Consider this now. Society, tradition, the law, all that is dead in some real sense. They are merely the remnant of the past. They are what is already fixed and invisible as we strive upward because of that fixedness. These are exactly what can be taken for granted, screened from consciousness by its predictability. By contrast, it is the future making itself manifest in the present that calls to consciousness. It is the potential of the future that makes itself manifest in the theater of consciousness. That is the eternal flowing of the water of chaos and life into the dead but necessary bedrock of traditional certainty. What or who masters that future? The locus of consciousness, the individual, the visionary and adventurous daring of the individual soul, the truly ethical striving of the individual capacity to imagine, think, and communicate. And those are all variants of the intrinsic logos. It is the sovereign individual who is shaper and potentially master of the indeterminate future. Or, more accurately, it is the consciousness manifesting itself within each individual who is such a master. Society can adapt to the future only insofar as it attends to and integrates the vision and thought, the logos of its citizens. Those who lead, therefore, must serve and foster that divine individuality, aggregate and unite its concerns, gather, amalgamate, and communicate its visionary wants and needs, and transform the law, the necessary but dead past, into the living and guiding word. The genuine leader, therefore, necessarily gazes into the abyss, into the suffering of his or her constituents, discovers the once great heroes of the past languishing in the underworld, identifies, rescues, and rejuvenates the eternally dying father, integrating the past with the present, and gives new life and vision to what has been established before. This is the eternal story, which has already happened and is happening now and will happen forever into any identifiably human future. This is what the ancient Egyptians discovered with their worship of the god Horus, the great eye of attention, the force that confronts chaos and evil and revivifies Osiris, god of the state, languishing blindly in the underworld. The state would grind to a halt, paralyzed by its mere instantiation of the dead past, if it failed to attend to the vision and thought of its current constituents. It is eternally the truthful visionary individual, the prophetic seer and voice, who stands against stagnation and tyranny. Even to maintain and propagate itself, the state must therefore subjugate itself to the logos of the individual. This is no mere ideology, no merely relative truth. It is instead that which must be primary, truly, so that hell does not make itself known. It is the denial and eradication of the logos of the individual that produced the tyrannical totalitarian regimes of the 20th century. We have by no means risen above the power-mad and hedonistic delights of such temptation. This does not mean that those who exist in the present can somehow do whatever they want. The state may be delimited by its need for the creative, renewing, and active vision of the individual, but equally, the individual must sacrifice his mere isolated and atomized individuality to the tradition that constitutes maturity and that unites us communally. In keeping with this vision, the state does not allow its citizens their freedom. The state that forbids its constituent individuals to pay attention and to speak the truth ossifies. The freedom that abides withers and dies in a fit of self-defeating and increasingly demoralizing lies. This is the victory akin to the evil brother of the king, the dark, resentful, egotistical uncle of the banished but true prince, and the dread event that sets the stage for plague, stagnation, and the disappearance of the very water of life. This is a truth beyond all mere relativistic objections. There is a necessarily reciprocal relation between state and citizen, and there is no manner in which the state is superordinate, although it provides what is necessarily static and stable. Without the individual, without you in a nutshell, without you embodying the appropriate ethos, the state would grind terribly to a halt. We, the human race, at least at its best, have determined through a painful process of trial and error that both tyranny and slavery are intrinsically wrong, as they both exist in contradistinction to this principle. The tyrant suppresses and simultaneously attempts to supplant the logos, while the enslaved are too intimidated and lazy, too faithless and arrogant in truth, to make that logos manifest within. This suppression and servitude dooms both individual and state, and not just dooms, if that doom is construed as mere death, but engenders instead a literal hell, which can in its full manifestation be something that makes even death preferable. Do you believe in your heart that slavery is wrong? Do you believe genuinely that the tyranny that insists on slavery is also wrong? Do you believe, therefore, in the intrinsic divinity of the individual, the deep worth of the individual, technically, given our working definitions? How otherwise can you possibly make sense of your objection to the slaveholding tyrant? To say it another way, the heartfelt opposition to compulsion and force, as well as the weak or hedonistic and immature irresponsibility that enables compulsion and force, even if it's merely felt or inchoately sensed, the feeling, for example, of violation produced by conscience, is faith, at least in the alternative to tyranny and slavery. A further question, once that definition is being clarified, do you oppose slavery and tyranny on the basis of your belief deeply enough to abide by the dictates of the creative logos? Or do you instead waver, construing the responsibility as too burdensome, and thereby abandon the true adventure and meaning of your life? The opposition to enslavement and force alike is genuine belief, and religious belief at that, as a matter of first principles. We fought many wars over whether or not the axiom of the divine intrinsic value of the individual man and woman is true, whether it is deeply, fundamentally, and non-arbitrarily true. Those who fought for freedom made many sacrifices to put that idea forward, to raise it to the highest place. Slavery was opposed and then substantively and painstakingly eradicated in the name of that same deep truth. And this was done for the deepest of religious reasons, positing against all immediately proximate evidence, the evidence of comparative wealth, power, and status, for example, that the soul of the individual was properly and ultimately sovereign, no matter how apparently lowly and excluded, positing that such value was no higher in the ultimate sense for those who were wealthy and great, no matter how rich or apparently important. The difficulty of such a realization should not be underestimated. It flies in the face of the most immediately self-evident facts, such as the fact of the ability of strength to dominate weakness and the evident advantages of wealth over poverty. If I can, why should I not? If I have the power, why are those who oppose me anything other than contemptible and weak? If I am rich, even by inheritance, is that not evidence, prima facie, that I am loved more by God or fate and nature, and therefore entitled to special status, as the facts indicate I should be? This was certainly the presumption of the classic pre-Judeo-Christian world, and is certainly the proclamation of the spirit possessing most individuals and societies today. Under the sway of the Spirit encapsulated in the biblical writings and traditions, we in the West realized that such favoritism and subjugation were wrong, fundamentally, that they violated some divinely deep principle, that they offended not merely some tenet of rationality or compassion, but the very spirit of what was great itself. We decided likewise that tyranny was immoral, whether it manifests itself within psyche, family, city, or state, that the king himself, regardless of his power, must bow to what is truly sovereign, and more importantly, that there is some celestial reality that is forever and truly superordinate to any earthly or secular ruler, or even to an explicit principle or law. It would be very careless and dangerous of us to forget that the impetus to do so, to eradicate slavery and tyranny, to subordinate authority to the transcendentally sovereign, was clearly, and I am speaking historically as well as psychologically, a consequence of the ethos established in nascent but potent form at the beginning of the Genesis account. Do we believe that we are made, man and woman alike, in the very image of God? And if so, what does it mean to believe? And if not, what do we believe instead? Or do we merely believe in nothing and suffer the terrible anxiety-provoking, hope-devouring, and socially destabilizing consequences of that? With the belief in God above in place, what do our marriages, families, friendships, and societies look like? And how do they appear when something else is substituted instead as goal or foundation? Is it not the case that tyranny or slavery will rule, and immediately at all of those levels, and equally at the level of the intrapersonal, psychological, or spiritual, if this cornerstone is rejected? And that tyranny and slavery are also inevitably allied with the domination of hedonistic whim and the short-term, immature, and narrowly self-centered gratification of desire that does not and cannot make for either a sustainable self-realization or a productive, generous, and harmonious polity. And what does acceptance of this proposition of divine intrinsic value mean if it is fully realized? Chapter 2. Adam, Eve, pride, self-consciousness, and the fall. 2.1. The image of God in the eternal garden. In Genesis 1, a series of narrative propositions emerge that existence is the consequence of an eternal transcendent spirit acting upon potential itself, that the habitable order that is good emerges from the workings of that spirit, that man and woman are made in the likeness of that spirit, and that this spirit is what has proper and eternal dominion over creation. Genesis 1 insists that man and woman are veritable images of God. Such an image is not God, precisely, but a low-resolution sampling of the original, something of the same nature in many ways, on a lesser, more restricted scale, something that is kenotic, emptied, in relationship to the original, something that is an icon or even avatar of the original. These presumptions are echoed very soon thereafter in Genesis 2, a chapter that offers a more deeply embodied primal portrayal. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Genesis 2:7. Is the idea of man as an image of God not utterly preposterous? How could flawed man, even the lowliest man or woman, possess a direct relationship to the divine? Man, with his propensity for decrepitude, suffering, and death, his self-evident insignificance contrasted with nature and the cosmos, the brevity of his life, why attribute value to something so fleeting in its existence and contemptible in its inadequacy? But in the absence of that divine proposition, where would we be? How could the common man otherwise be credited with any a priori status whatsoever, particularly in relation to those fully capable of enacting the principle of might that would otherwise definitely make right and often threatens to, regardless? How could we possibly manage, without the tradition of inalienable rights and intrinsic individual responsibility, that is the logical consequence of that axiomatic proclamation of our sacred worth? That insistence is a notion both unlikely and significant beyond measure. It is perhaps the greatest idea ever revealed, and as the central idea of the biblical corpus, it is the very foundation of the Judeo-Christian tradition. This is an axiom, a proclamation, something that must be established as a cornerstone before any society whatsoever can appear, something that must be accepted in faith as a necessary rule before the game can even begin. Much of the faith that is truly religious is of the same form. It is not the insistence that something superstitious or impossible was true, but the proclamation and definition of what constitutes, compromises, or characterizes the real, and that should therefore be attended to most diligently and acted on. This is irreducibly a decision, not least because we can never know enough ahead of time to be certain, and must move forward with assumption in the face of our ignorance. Marriage offers a helpful analogy. A marriage cannot commence without faith in its permanence. Is the evidence for its permanence there prior to the commitment? No. Furthermore, the evidence that would be necessary cannot be gathered in any manner without the a priori commitment, the vow to play that particular game and none other. All the crucial decisions of life are made on principle, not in consequence of sufficient evidence. That does not mean that we should move forward stupidly and blindly. Whenever we face the truly unknown, however, we are obliged to move forward with faith. The alternative is grim indeed. In Genesis 2, God's transformation of chaos and nothingness into habitable being is particularized. God creates the first truly human place of habitation. And the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and became into four heads. Genesis 2:8-10. This garden is the optimal human environment, represented in imaginative abstraction. It is the archetypal dwelling place where culture or order, the walls, and nature or chaos, the plants, trees, birds, and animals, coexist in proper balance. It is both origin and eternal perfect destination. The walled garden, for that is what the word paradise, paradisa, means, the well-watered place, for that is what the word Eden means. It is the reestablishment of that optimal place that is the implicit goal of every homeowner who envisions a backyard garden, his or her own fenced-in variant of the original Eden. And even if the fence is manifest only in the abstract, as ownership, the enclosure is still walled by the boundaries of social convention. Men and women work or sacrifice naturally toward establishing an environment that eternally circumscribes nature within culture, one that protects and shelters, while also enabling and providing opportunity. We dream of our own private green and natural space, and failing that, at least an apartment close to a park. We want it hemmed in, separated, bordered. We want to know exactly what we're responsible for and have a right to in relation to the expectation and property of others. We then strive to make it beautiful, peaceful, and secure, and are intrinsically oriented toward that perfection. That orientation is a spirit, a process or pattern that inhabits us, piques our interest, directs our attention, and motivates our action. What do we want to happen there in our gardens if and when we get it right? We may well be incapable of tending the whole world, but we can manage our own small private natural spaces, and that is far from nothing. How might we envision such a place? What are we doing with that small section of land if we summon the right spirit? When a new building was established in traditional India, before a single stone is laid, the astrologer shows what spot in the foundation is exactly above the head of the snake that supports the world. The mason fashions a little wooden peg from the wood of the Kadira tree, and with a coconut, drives the peg into the ground at this particular spot in such a way as to peg the head of the snake securely down. If this snake should ever shake its head really violently, it would shake the world to pieces. A foundation stone is placed above the peg. The cornerstone is thus situated exactly at the center of the world. But the act of foundation at the same time repeats the cosmogonic act, for to secure the snake's head, to drive the peg into it, is to imitate the primordial gesture of Soma, Rig Veda 2, 12.1, or of Indra, when the latter smote the serpent in his lair, Rig Veda 6, 17.9, when his thunderbolt cut off his head, Rig Veda 1, 52.10. This pegging down of the shifting snake that underlies everything, no matter how invisibly, is the planting of the rod of custom or flagstaff in the center to stabilize and orient ourselves and the community. It is the dynamic between guiding staff and serpent that Moses has mastered and displays for the Pharaoh, the Egyptians, and the Israelites. It is even the spear that St. George and St. Michael drive through the heart of the dragon to defeat chaos and evil. We want and need our walled garden to be delimited. We want it to be ours so that we can benefit in the long run from our short-term sacrifices of time, effort, and money in pursuit of our dream. Hence the walls. We invite nature to express herself within the confines of those constraints in a manner that is attractive and interesting. We work toward that goal, that vision of the promised land. In that work, we find peace and happiness. We can sit out there with our family and our friends in a hospitable manner, dining at the celestial table, so to speak. There is a spirit that inhabits us. Well, we do that if it is done properly. It is the same word that gives rise to garden and cosmos. The proper environment of the men and women made in the image of God is the place optimally balanced between culture and nature, between order and chaos. That is also the place, as we have seen, of optimized consciousness. This Edenic environment has been traditionally represented, and is so described in the text, as a territory divided by rivers into four parts. And a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and became into four heads, Genesis 2:10. Such a division and arrangement forms a geometric structure known as a mandala, which is a cross superimposed on a circle and often, but not necessarily, surrounded by a square. A mandala is a representation of optimized order. As such, the psychological or conceptual equivalent of paradise, this fourfold division stemming from a center, is the place man always stands in the world, with the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west, stretching out from there. It has the same cruciform structure as a cathedral, which is an architectural image of the idea of a divine or heavenly center, as well as a concrete instantiation of Eden. The garden theme permeates cathedral design, duplicating the primeval forest in stone with branching tree-like arches and illumination flooding in through its stained glass windows, just as the sunlight in a grove filters through leaves and branches. 2.2. Pride versus the sacred moral order. In Genesis 2, God establishes the walled garden and grants man dominion over it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "Of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat." Genesis 2:15. In this manner, God provides man and woman with almost complete freedom to explore, incorporate, and otherwise use everything the world provides, with two important exceptions. First is the command to exercise dominion in a manner that replenishes the earth and puts everything in its proper place, Genesis 1:28, and likewise to dress the garden and keep it, Genesis 2:15. Second, they are to avoid ingesting the fruit of one of the central trees in the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Genesis 2:17. Life in the properly managed Edenic garden is something extant in a state of dynamic play, order challenged, updated, and extended by chaos, man dynamically juxtaposed against, competing, and cooperating with woman, man and woman operating according to God's will, realizing themselves as images of God, continually extending and further perfecting that which is already good or very good. Paradise thus has the same nature as a great piece of music, say, the third movement of Bach's Third Brandenburg Concerto, a composition unparalleled both in its ability to balance the predictable and expected against the unpredictable and novel, and to simultaneously bring forth out of something already beautiful and perfect, something ever more beautiful and still more perfect. This is a mode of being, of ever-improving harmony, exemplified by music, the condition toward which all art constantly aspires. This is the good that can become very good. But humanity is also called upon, while attending and acting, to leave the very moral foundations of the world in place, unchallenged, or even untouched entirely, in the rejection of the forbidden fruit. Something is therefore deemed to remain necessary forever beyond human judgment, with regard to the nature of good and evil. Something is to be set immovably at the base, or elevated permanently to the highest place. Something is to be regarded as transcendentally untouchable or ineffable. Is this not precisely the set of moral principles already established and insisted upon? The fact of the eternal interplay between order and chaos, God and Tehom? The presumption that the order realized by the word is good and that human beings are very good? The idea that man and woman are made in the image of God? These axioms are not to be made part of the domain of human knowledge or replaced by some hypothetically useful or convenient earthly dogma. They are instead to remain sacred, to forever serve and be regarded and treated as the very preconditions for that knowledge. Genesis 2, therefore, extends the characterization of God, presenting him as the spirit that warns against overreach, against the cardinal sin of pride. What might overreach mean? Paradise or Eden is eternally a garden with two primordial fruit-bearing trees at its center. And out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Genesis 2:9. These two trees bear some deep and mysterious relationship to each other. The tree of life bears the fruit whose incorporation brings life, even eternal life. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil is its opposite. It is the tree that harbors the eternal serpent and bears the fruit whose incorporation brings death. What does this mean? That which is necessarily and inevitably axiomatic, that upon which everything else depends, is to be touched at great peril. That which is axiomatic and foundational provides protection against the chaos that shatters, against the entropy that swirls, dissolves, consumes hope, and drowns. Something has to be held as sacred. In this case, the very foundation upon which good and evil themselves are predicated. This is the stake driven through the head of the underground serpent whose movement would otherwise shake the world to pieces. It is a great sin of pride, the great sin of pride, to question that which upon everything necessarily depends. Do not touch what must necessarily remain sacred. Otherwise, the center cannot hold and things fall apart. Something has to be the unmovable object, the sacred staff, the unshakable pillar, and even perhaps the tree for the serpent. Something has to be that around which everything else arranges itself. That is God himself, ineffable though he may be. The closer to God the presumption, the more care must be taken in its approach, let alone its rejection or revolutionary overthrow. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, something said in many forms by many people. The attempt to make the moral enterprise a matter of human judgment, rather than to leave in place a necessary minimum of assumptions, is to make the prideful move that transforms the rock upon which the house would otherwise stand into the sand that shifts, moves, and devours when the storm comes. It is in keeping with this that Christ, the very incarnation of the Word that established such principles, much later insists. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house. And it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. And everyone that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. Matthew 7:24-27. The finite and known is surrounded by the infinite and unknown. The former cannot subsume the latter. If it tries, overextending itself, it risks perishing. It is necessary, even crucial, to understand the periphery, the margin, is not merely a singular antithesis to the one at the center, nor its opposite, as is commonly presumed. The opposite of the one is not the other, but the many, and then the innumerable, and then the monstrous, and then inconceivable, and then the utter chaos that is worse than death. The opposite of the one is multiplicity itself, the very multiplicity whose revolutionary triumph might well deprioritize the center, however temporarily it manages such a thing. Nonetheless, that victory will wreak havoc among whatever peripheral or experimental phenomena that had managed to find a place in the margin of tolerance that necessarily surrounds any ideal. This is true not least because the peripheral or experimental has a more fragile grip on identity than the center and can therefore be destabilized with greater ease. The semi-functional or avant-garde operates therefore nearer those who walk the straight and narrow path than among the extreme outliers of the frontier, regardless of their opinion about such matters. The extreme outliers are monsters who would devour and destroy everything, including the avant-garde, and perhaps and likely the latter first. To put it another way, the fringe can exist around the center with some care taken on both sides. It can exist in a fragile, but perhaps mutually beneficial truce, given the advantages of both stability and variation. If the fringe clamors to be centered, however, in consequence of falling prey to the resentment and bitterness that is almost inevitably part of life in the shadow of the ideal, then the fringe of the fringe will begin to make its appearance. when the ideal, that terrible but necessary judge, weakens, and maybe in a manner that is welcome to the excluded, even the oppressed, then the predatory and parasitical dragons of the truly chaotic come storming back. What then? The now falsely elevated, previously marginal, and now hypothetically centered are the first heads on the chopping block. It is also the case that centering the margin would eliminate whatever hedonic utility the marginal, in fact, possesses. It is the fact of the transgression and the novelty that accompanies such deviant action that raises the fetish, whatever its nature, to the status of aphrodisiac. Novelty itself is a form of incentive reward. Thus, participation in novel acts, which are by definition marginal, although they can be positive in an exploratory way as well as rebellious in a merely transgressive way, heightens pleasure. This is as true for aesthetic pleasures, ranging from the gustatory to the artistic, as it is on the sexual front. Thus, the movement of the marginal to the position of norm or ideal undermines even the pathologically immature exacerbation of pleasure that is the goal of so many marginal practices, and threatens even the more genuine and valid pleasure that is to be experienced as a consequence of participation in the true and even redemptive avant-garde. This is another disadvantage, particularly to the creative, of all attempts to permanently subvert the normal or ideal order. If everyone is or has to wear a dog mask, for example, no one can have any disobedient fun in one. Because the marginal is multiplicity, the marginalized cannot be celebrated. As celebrated means raised to the place of primacy, and a plethora cannot be made the focus of singular attention. By definition, by the very fact of the difference between the one and the many, the man who bites off more than he can chew, or the society that does the same, therefore risks choking, risks death, or worse, in the attempt to incorporate the inedible. The knowledge of man cannot, in the final analysis, maintain its integrity in the face of everything that is as of yet and possibly even forever unknown. What stops the infinite regress of doubt in the face of genuine ultimate ignorance? To ask why forever? When I was teaching at the University of Toronto, I often demonstrated this to my seminar students, choosing one of them to harass, asking him or her, "Why did you do the readings for this class?" "Because I wanted to be prepared for the discussion." "Why did it matter to you if you were thus prepared?" "Because I wanted to do well in the class." "Why did you care to do well?" "Because I wanted to pass the course." "Why does it matter to you if you pass the course?" "Because I want to get my degree." "Why do you care to get your degree?" "I want to be competitive in the job market after I graduate." "Why does such success make any difference to you?" It was at this point, climbing Jacob's ladder or descending into the underworld, that the going often began to get difficult for the person so questioned. "If I do not have a good job, I will be miserable and have no money." "Why does it matter to anyone, including you, if you are suffering and broke?" At the end of Tolstoy's Confessions, detailing not least his descent into an intensely suicidal nihilism and consequent emergence, the great Russian author describes a dream, condensed and rearranged for the purposes of the present illustration. "I see that I'm lying in bed, feeling neither good nor bad. I'm lying on my back. But I begin to wonder whether it is a good thing for me to be lying there. And it seems to me that there is something wrong with my legs. Whether they are too short or uneven, I do not know, but there's something awkward about them. Only now do I ask myself what had not yet occurred to me. Where am I and what am I lying on? I begin to look around, and the first place I look is down, toward where my body is dangling. in the direction where I feel I must soon fall. I look below and I cannot believe my eyes. I'm resting on a height such as I could never have imagined, a height altogether unlike that of the highest tower or mountain. Looking about my bed, I see that I'm lying on some cords woven together and attached to the sides of the bed. My heels are resting on one of the cords and my lower legs on another in an uncomfortable way. Somehow I know that these cords can be shifted. My heart stops and I'm overcome with horror. It is horrible to look down there. I feel that if I look down, I will immediately slip from the last cord and perish. I do not look. Yet not looking is worse, for now I'm thinking about what will happen to me as soon as the last cord breaks. I feel that I am losing the last ounce of my strength from sheer terror and that my back is slowly sinking lower and lower. Another instant, and I shall break away. Above me, there is also an abyss. I gaze into this abyss of sky and try to forget about the one below. And I actually do forget. The infinity below repels and horrifies me. The infinity above attracts me, gives me strength. Thus, I am hanging over the abyss, suspended by the last of the cords that have not yet slipped out from under me. I know I am hanging there, but I am only looking upward, and my terror passes. As it happens in a dream, a voice is saying, "Mark this. This is it." I gaze deeper and deeper into the infinity above me, and I seem to grow calm. There is no necessary place or point where the questioning ends. It can all too easily become the infinite regress that quells motivation and petrifies or paralyzes. No students attending in a class, indeed, no people participating in any activity whatsoever, do so without assuming something. Do so except on the basis of a faith, however implicit that faith might be. The buck has to stop somewhere. Otherwise, they would be mired in doubt, indecisive, stuck at a crossroads, falling apart, headed every which or no way at all, instead of focusing on the task at hand. This state of confusion is all too likely. When individuals and societies lose faith in their goals at any level of the heavenly hierarchy, they question and then subvert their identity or purpose and end up lost in the desert, anxious, depressed, and devoid of hope, bitter and cynical, untethered and nihilistic, hedonistic and power mad, paralytic inaction and fragmented confusion are the default state. This happens when the integrity or even the existence of the topmost level becomes questionable, and perhaps most devastatingly, even if the full consequences of this collapse take decades or longer to manifest. Thus, a certain faith in cosmos, garden, and self constitutes a necessary foundation for forward movement, an inescapable foundation even, because the alternative is the infinite regress of doubt and the descent into the abyss. None of this is to say that deep questioning is never called for. In the face of repeated failure, the presumptions guiding our movement must be challenged step by step, deeper, incrementally, if modest correction fails. But the baby should not be thrown out with the bathwater every time an obstacle appears. This is particularly true when the baby in question is the divine infant. What is the rule instead? Minimal correction necessary to keep the ship on course or to reestablish a new destination. How can we find what we have faith in, even if we do not know explicitly that such faith is there? By noting where our questioning stops, whether the questions are asked by another person or realized themselves personally in the form of doubt. If the blocks of our foundation have not been made explicit, made conscious objects of apprehension, or statable, imaginable, or at least imitable principles, they are still there implicitly, insofar as the journey uphill is continuing. A religious tradition is the revelation and communication of the necessarily axiomatic, at least in dramatic and narrative form. These stories that unite keep everyone moving in the same direction, looking at the same world, experiencing the same emotions. There is little difference between that and productive peace. Is it true that the more these stories are understood as well as told, the more union appears, both psychologically and communally? It is a good thing to imitate, act out, and imagine. But if conscious understanding is also on board, then one additional source of disunion has been not only eliminated, but transformed into something that can now serve as an active participant rather than as a mere critical observer. The axioms of traditional morality are stakes in the ground, rods of tradition. But every rod of tradition has its accompanying serpent, the living spirit that originally established the tradition and that constantly renews it. 2.3. The incompleteness of Adam and the arrival of Eve. Adam's role as naming spirit has just been established when the story takes an odd segue. And Adam gave names to all cattle, and to the fowl of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found an helpmeet for him. Genesis 2:20. It is not Eve who is directly assigned the task of naming. She is instead a necessary partner to that conceptualizing process. Speaking or standing, optimally in a beneficial or even playful manner, for that which has not yet been included in the domain of conceptualization or within the process of generating the habitable order that is good or very good. Why? Well, she is, after all, the archetypal mother of mankind, as well as mate and partner to Adam. Perhaps that outsider status is the eternal situation of the child, with his or her individual and particularized peculiarities and idiosyncrasies, as well as notable and unique special talents. Any new child, for example, or any change in the circumstances or personality of any child, must be incorporated into the currently extant functional order, Adam's domain, which must in consequence broaden or transform to meet the new set of wants and needs. The cry of the child, more generally, the vulnerable or excluded, is the paramount concern of the eternal mother. There are a variety of potential reasons for the marked and consistent sex differences discussed earlier. Some of these differences arise in women at the time of sexual maturation, and for reasons related to precisely that, the difference in the experience of negative emotion, and therefore self-consciousness, emerges in adolescence. This is perhaps because the size and strength differences between men and women, particularly in the upper body power so key to victory in physical combat, also appear at that time, making additional anxiety-mediated caution in relationship to men necessary and wise. Further, it is at puberty when the potential cataclysm of unwanted pregnancy first threatens. But the fundamental driving force behind the differentiation of women from men in personality and interest is likely the need for heightened responsivity to threat and for close relationships that aid in care for dependent others. It is post-adolescent women who are most reliably and consistently called on to care for vulnerable infants, for example. There is no reason to assume a priori that the emotional responses of women have evolved only for their immediate personal benefit, rather than to aid in both survival and reproductive success considered over the longer term. It makes more sense to consider the heightened anxiety and self-consciousness of women a negotiated solution to the joint problems of the mother-infant dyad. The depth of such proclivity for self-sacrifice should not be underestimated. It reaches into the very bones themselves. Women can detect, while breastfeeding, the lack of sufficient calcium in the bodies of their infants, for example, and will even decalcify their own skeletons, spilling the resultant excess into their breast milk to redress the lack in their children. It is no coincidence, perhaps, that the sacred image of woman is not so much woman as it is woman and infant. What is a woman alone? A target of short-term sexual gratification, made so by the venality of men oriented towards such a pursuit, although enticed into such things by the possession of her own hedonism. A pawn in the patriarchal order, just as a man might be, although without the full panoply of benefits that social status per se confers upon men. There is no reason whatsoever to assume that the fundamental unit of psychological integration or social order is the atomized and subjectively defined individual. This goes for men, too, who are unlikely to be men and much more likely to be immature hedonists or manipulative power players until they become masters of the responsibility that appears with woman and child. The classic liberal emphasis on the individual works only when the individual, so defined, is already enmeshed, however unconsciously, in a transcendental ethos or story that makes his or her individuality one of voluntarily self-sacrificial responsibility rather than a manifestation of might or whim. Women's heightened self-consciousness spills over into the domain of men because men are required to adapt themselves to women and their concerns. The female proclivity for increased experience of negative emotion and heightened sensitivity to interpersonal interaction and conflict means that they are also more likely to highlight, by inference and direct action, the perennial inadequacy of men. This is why the scales fall from Adam's eyes when he eats the fruit offered to him by Eve. He becomes self-conscious, aware of his own nakedness, something he then forever blames on the woman or on God himself for creating her. The male need to be attractive to women means that men will bend over backward to provide, or, in the case of pathological men, appear to provide, whatsoever is desired by a potential mate. Women are much more likely than men to reject others, sexually and with regard to relationship. They are much more likely to refuse a given sexual overture when so-called short-term mating opportunities arise. They also precipitate divorce in some 70% of cases. Further, women are more prone to engage in indirect relational aggression and gossip with the end goal of socially ostracizing a potential rival. This proclivity arguably increases the self-consciousness of men. Women, with their higher capacity for decoding nonverbal behavior, are also more sensitive to displays of female physical attractiveness and mate poaching behavior, such as flirting, and are likely to punish that harshly, even among their friends. Heaven has no rage like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned. What does all this suggest? Women aggregate the concerns of those they are specialized in some deep sense to attend to and care for. They then bring these concerns to the attention of their male partners, specialized in turn for outward striving, confronting the natural enemies of hearth and kin, competing and cooperating for hierarchical positioning, and garnering the benefits thereof in the broader social world. In that manner, women benefit from the additional resources that men can bring to bear on the problems of dependent care, even as they struggle under the necessity of providing that care. Men, in turn, benefit from an expansion of their self-consciousness, and then consciousness, under the pressure of women's heightened sensitivity, while bearing the brunt of the harsh evaluation and rejection that is part and parcel of that gift. 2.4, the eternal sins of Eve and Adam. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, Yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. And the serpent said unto the woman, ye shall not surely die. For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. And the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Genesis 3:1-7. Imagine that your life is progressing well. You dwell in an orderly, beautiful garden, optimally balanced between structure and possibility. But you have neither incorporated nor conquered all things. You have established a conceptual structure, but a fringe remains, that which, or indeed those who, do not fit the ordered pattern and are marginalized. Should the order be restructured so that all those who do not fit can now be included? This is not simply managed. A veritable multitude of forms lurk on the margin. No multiplicity can be made the center of a unity, and there is no perception, much less stability or hope, in the absence of a unity. All? All is too much. Inclusion of the margin means entropy overwhelms order, and if the margin is not sufficient to overwhelm, the margin of the margin will most definitely suffice. Every fringe has its more extreme fringe. The act of categorization is a determination of order, the order that is necessary, but also forever incomplete, and sometimes direly so. Therefore, something or someone must stand for that which has not yet been brought or incorporated into the structure of order. The union of the capacity to categorize an order with the necessity of attending to that which is still outside and lost constitutes the complete human spirit, most accurately reflecting the spirit of God. Genesis emphasizes this unity. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Genesis 2:24. C.G. Jung notes further, man's imagination has been preoccupied with this idea over and over again on the high and even the highest levels of culture, as we can see from the late Greek and syncretic philosophy of Gnosticism. The hermaphroditic rebus had an important part to play in the natural philosophy of the Middle Ages. And in our own day, we hear of Christ's androgyny in Catholic mysticism. This unity of masculine and feminine will be seen in the heroic Christ, who exists in implicit form, say, as the unborn Savior of the world within Mary, or the maternal implicit within Christ, manifest as the love that redeems the world. The feminine, Mary, is thus the mandorla that encapsulates both God the Father and the crucified Son. This union is the order superimposed on a background of chaos and possibility, giving rise to the redemptive, self-sacrificing Word itself, the Word that is in turn the divine individual, who, fully and completely, accepts his fate in the world, his destiny. The consequence of this union, at least initially, when it is operating in the proper spirit, is ultimate protection against the catastrophe of self-consciousness, represented as nakedness. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Genesis 2:25. That self-consciousness is precisely what emerges in the aftermath of prideful overreach. Eve falls prey to temptation and consorts with the serpent. That serpent is both what is marginal, even monstrous, as the snake is a truly and genuinely poisonous agent, and the eternal temptation of pride, the pride that wishes to usurp or take the place of God. We can imagine the serpent's approach, whispering, embrace me, and take to yourself the prerogative of the divine, mastery over the moral order itself, definition of good and evil itself. Eve's sin, and therefore the eternal temptation or flaw of the feminine? My compassion is so all-encompassing that it can convert and incorporate even that which is deadly poison. My compassion is so total that it can transform such poison into veritable nourishment, and the nourishment of the enlightened at that. This sudden awareness of something that is deeply unconscious produces a spasm of self-consciousness. Eve discovers the dread depth of her presumption. Adam follows as he allows himself to be tempted by his new partner, and in doing so, by her new partner, who is both the poisonous serpent and, at a higher level of abstraction, the eternal adversary himself, as the most poisonous of possible snakes. Both the mother and father of mankind are tempted to assimilate something that cannot and must not be consumed, albeit for different reasons specific to each sex, and everything falls apart. The enlightenment longed for and motivating this sin certainly descends, as Genesis immediately relates, although not in the manner expected and not in a manner that anyone truly awake and properly humble would wish for. The serpent is subtle, camouflaged, lurking, masquerading as something that it is not, indistinguishable from the undergrowth or foliage, blending in almost perfectly with what has already been taken for granted, tempting the unwary to assume that it is something it is not. It looks so harmless. What could possibly go wrong? This is the parasite's or predator's pretense of irrelevance. Could the gates not open for them too? That is a fine question when it is motivated by a compassion that is truly discerning, judicious, and discriminating, but something utterly inappropriate when it is asked for no other reason than to falsely and deceptively elevate the perceived moral status of the questioner. Eve's sin, hearkening to the blandishments of the eternally serpentine. Adam's sin, hearkening endlessly to the voice of Eve. Sins of pride in both cases. In Eve's, the narcissism of compassion. I am the mother who can encompass all. Adam's sin? I can retool and rename order itself indefinitely, all to impress Eve. Both presume too much, albeit for different reasons, reasons that nonetheless find their union in that prideful sin. The temptation that eternally confronts the woman, therefore, is the idea that maternal benevolence can be pridefully extended to the entire world, to even the most poisonous of snakes, and the associated temptation to make much of that on the social front, to use her compassion, however ill-placed and false, to claim unearned moral virtue and ability, to draw undeserved attention to herself from individual men of interest or within her broader social community. Maternal compassion is the spirit of the feminine bestowed on the individual woman. It is not something to take pride in, as it is not, as such, an individual accomplishment. It is instead something that can be invited in to possess, and that must be regarded in humility as a gift from God, a talent bestowed, rather than a flag of virtue to be presumptuously and self-servingly paraded. The parallel temptation confronting the man is to hearken to this false voice of inclusive and indiscriminate familiarity and kinship, and to claim, for his own self-serving and self-aggrandizing purposes, the capacity to expand beyond its limits the domain over which he has established a certain degree of mastery. There is a corresponding and equally deadly sin of Adam, the fundamental temptation or flaw of the masculine, the proclamation to Eve, I can incorporate, master, name, and subdue, and put into proper order anything that you bring before me, no matter how overreaching, preposterous, or even outright deadly the presumption that it be included. All to impress Eve, as men do so often to impress women. One terrible reality of this destructive dance is how closely it resembles the deepest moral striving and ability when genuine, We should strive to further our domain of care and to extend our responsibility. And the worst of all possible sins, the eternal fall, when it is not, when we falsely lay claim to what we have managed and mastered. God help us all, truly, in the face of our prideful compassion and false confidence. How much of the suffering of the world is a consequence of presumptuous overreach, of the desire to usurp and to claim for ourselves something that we cannot manage, do not deserve, and should serve instead of strive to so falsely master? How much suffering enters the world with the fall of man into presumption and pride? There is something to this insistence that is ignored at our peril. The concerns Eve brings to Adam force him to restructure his personality and, more broadly, the social order he has established and is responsible for both maintaining and updating. Every man is, of course, a work in progress, and the social order is always incomplete, not least as a consequence of its exclusionary and often too arbitrary nature. But that does not mean that all men can perforce be rejected until some perfect specimen emerges, or that order can be dispensed with altogether, or that it can be infinitely, immediately, and on demand expanded. Further, the inadequacy of man does not imply the superiority of women, and the presumption of that superiority on moral grounds inevitably leads to devastating consequences. Of course, the reverse is equally true. Imagine that something is not known to a given man, or that he is not taking appropriate care in some regard, particularly when he should have known or cared, given his age, knowledge, competence, or status. Some might perceive in this lack a lurking immaturity or other shameful inadequacy. Now, imagine that lack is suddenly highlighted in direct consequence of female dissatisfaction and rejection, emotional or sexual. Then, consider the anger, bitterness, and even desire for revenge against her, world, himself, and God that might emerge. As Adam said to God, unforgivably, "The woman who thou gavest to me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." Genesis 3:12. The first man could have taken another tack. He could have rejected his new partner's request, remained obedient to the divine, and foregone the fall entirely, instead of pridefully accepting Eve's challenge. Even in the aftermath of his error, he could have refused to cast the blame on his mate and the divine force that produced her, accepted responsibility for his insufficiency, and atoned. But no, worse, he doubled down on his pride, extending it even to self-righteously and self-pityingly claiming moral superiority over God. Thus, everything that transpired, and that continues to do so. To eat is to consume, incorporate, assimilate, develop, grow. Not everything can be eaten, however. Only what is meat, so to speak. Only everything in proper proportion, and certainly not what is poison, no matter how tempting and attractive. The serpent is anomaly itself, the infinite, forever lurking within the finite, that which does not fit. It is the dragon whose treasure eternally tempts. It is also, however, that which cannot be incorporated. The fruit of the immortal serpent is that which cannot be made edible. But the temptation to bite off more than can be chewed, nonetheless, perpetually beckons. 2.5. The Eternal Serpent. Why do we associate the serpent in the garden with Satan himself? There is no direct indication of such a relationship in the text itself. So we have to look more broadly for an answer to nature, to tradition, and to context. The serpent is the proximal predator or adversary, that which is poison and which devours concretely here and now, as in the case of an actual viper, crocodile, shark, or python. Satan, by contrast and extension, is the adversary as such. The bite of a poisonous snake is certainly to be feared. Children have to be protected against such an eventuality, And it is a heroic task to confront a poisonous reptile and to provide such shelter. Imagine this task, writ large. Satan is the psychological or abstract equivalent of the concretely predatory and venomous, the worst of all conceivable snakes, the eternal meta-snake. His dwelling place is not the undergrowth of the garden of the natural world, but the nether reaches of the human soul. His defeat occurs as a consequence not of hunting and killing, as when a nest of vipers is put to the flame, but of true moral striving, which is the most fundamental pattern of the activities characterizing, for example, the serpent-slaying saints George and Patrick and the archangel Michael at the end or culmination of time, Revelation 12, 7 to 9. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels, and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Satan, as the essence of the predatory, parasitical, and reptilian, is the spirit of murderous resentment, the prince of lies and darkness, the adversary of being, the shameless accuser, the essence of malevolence. He is as well the king of pride, the pride that sets itself up over God and claims that the transcendent can be dispensed with in favor of his rule. This characterization is stressed in the opening stanzas of John Milton's Paradise Lost, which gives the following account of the great deceiver. The infernal serpent, he it was whose guile stirred up with envy and revenge, deceived the mother of mankind. What time his pride had cast him out from heaven with all his host of rebel angels, by whose aid aspiring to set himself in glory above his peers. He trusted to have equaled the Most High if he opposed, and with ambitious aim against the throne and monarchy of God, raised impious war in heaven and battle proud with vain attempt. It is specifically the pride of Satan, according to Milton, that entices forward the corresponding sentiment and wish to rule in Eve and then in Adam. To know good and evil is not merely to possess the knowledge of what is moral, as both Adam and Eve already know the rules. And the Lord God commanded him, "You may eat freely from every tree of the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die." Genesis 2, 16 to 17. The knowledge indicated refers to the complete mastery that would allow for what is good and evil to be fashioned, altered, and defined by human design. This is precisely what the spirit of satanic pride offers Eve, even implying as he does so that the only reason for the original prohibition was something akin to God's envy or jealousy. "For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil." Genesis 3:5. This is the taking to self, not merely the ability to revalue all values in the sense meant and recommended by Nietzsche, but the ability to create values, to serve as the veritable source of value itself, the capability of God himself. This capability is simply not within the purview of man. The eternal values are given as the bedrock of the identity that confers upon man and woman the essence of humanity itself. To be human is to share not only physical, but metaphysical form, the very identity of value that is, for example, a precondition for any communication that does not degenerate into an infinite regress of questioning. Thus, we might ask someone, "Why are you angry?" but are not required to inquire, "What do you mean, angry?" as the fact of our shared structure of bedrock values means that we all know, as humans, what being angry means. The same can be said not only of our basic emotional or motivational states, but also of the manner in which those potentially competing states come to organize themselves into higher order unities, both psychological and social. There is a domain of allowable variation, and experimentation is allowed and even encouraged on the fringe, but there is also an immutable center. This is the self-evident fact that gives the concept of shared humanity, or even human being, both its reality and its comprehensibility. This means, by necessity, that any man or woman who steps outside the domain of the eternal human values has essentially ceased to be human and has therefore not so much transcended the human as destroyed it. What such stepping outside almost inevitably means in practice as well is not the grand and heroic transvaluation upward envisioned by Nietzsche. It is instead the degeneration and fragmentation of a uniting morality.